Downtown Productions in cooperation with Zone Radio presents Downtown the Podcast. From the historic Zone Radio studios, here's your host, Rich Kimball.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome into Downtown the Podcast. Brought to you every week by Renewal by Anderson, your trusted window and door replacement expert. Offering free in-home consultation, and right now, get 20% off your entire project and an additional $299 off. In Maine, call them at 207-275-6622 or visit renewalbyanderson.com. Episode number 303 this week. And a couple of talented folks on the program a little bit later on. Actor Jake Reiner talks with us about his brand new film, Love and Taxes. Up first, a legendary sports writer and sportscaster, Hall of Famer, first with the Boston Globe, many years with CBS. She has done it all and seen it all through her long career. And she's going to be part of a special event going on the 14th of April down in Reading, Massachusetts, a gathering of what many have called the greatest sports writing staff of all time, that Boston Globe sports team from the mid-1970s through the 1980s. We're talking about our friend Leslie Visser. We caught up with her recently here on Downtown.
Oh, Rich, first of all, it's so great to talk to you. I know we talked baseball and hockey, and this is really wonderful. A guy put together, Mike Connolly, put together a group of us from the Globe. And, you know, whenever people say to me, oh, didn't you used to be a writer? I say, no, a writer is all I am, and that is the best that I will be, because I got to write when the Boston Globe had all, you know, they were all, we're all Halls of Famers, I guess, is that how you say it? But, you know, it was like Peter Gammons was the best on baseball, Bob Ryan, the best on basketball, Lee Montville, one of the greatest coaches. I used to cover Wimbledon with Bud Collins, of course, the NFL with Will McDonough. So actually, when CBS came to hire me, I said, why would I leave the Globe?
And all of this possible because of a Carnegie Foundation offer in the summer of 74, when you had an eight-week internship, essentially, with the Globe?
I did. Oh, thanks for asking. I wanted to be a sports writer. From the time I was 10 years old, the job did not exist for women. And I told my mom, she said I was 10, we were living in Cincinnati, and she said, what do you think you want to be? She was a teacher. And I said, oh, I want to be a sports writer. And she didn't say, you know, you have to be so great with your kids, because she didn't say, oh, girls can't do that, you won't be able to do that. She said, that's great. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk. So it was really profound for me. And yeah, in my junior year at Boston College, I applied for a Carnegie Foundation grant that it was open to 20 women in America who wanted to go into jobs that were 95% male, which sports writing was 100% male. So I won one of them, and I got to go to the Globe on the foundation grant.
And then you ended up as a beat writer for the Patriots starting in 1975. And it was, is it safe to say that was a lonely place for a woman to be in those days?
You know, I look back on it. Maybe you were like this too, Rich, or some of your listeners. I had to have been protected by my innocence, because it was nuts. I mean, they didn't have a ladies' room in the press box, so I'd have to wait till I was the first woman to cover the NFL as a beat. And I'd have to wait, you know, Patriots first and 10 on the 20, and I think, okay, can I get down the elevator across to the public restroom and run back up like Usain Bolt? And, you know, the Patriots were not the gold standard that we've come to know. They usually punted after three downs. But, you know, I used to go around the world. This is a true story. And I'd say, you know, like at Wimbledon, hi, I'm Leslie Visser from the Boston Globe. I work with Bud Collins. And, you know, the heavens would open. And on football, same thing. I work with Will McDonough. I work with Peter Gammons. I work with Bob. So it's really meant a lot. Dan Shaughnessy and I started the same summer. We covered high school football.
And I think it was Will McDonough who gave you the great advice, laugh now, cry later.
Oh, he really saved me. Okay, here's an embarrassing story. let's see. all right, so the Patriots were going down to play, I think it was Miami. You know, they were great, Miami, those 1970 Miami team. And I was really nervous, and I asked Chuck Fairbanks who was going to start at left tackle. They had two guys, Bob McKay and Tom Neville, and I think both were kind of injured. And Chuck Fairbanks said, neither one can play the position. So I went screaming back to the Globe. We didn't have computers or anything then. I drove 1,000 miles an hour. This is the scoop of the century. The coach says no one can protect Steve Grogan. So I go back there. We write it. It's in the paper the next day. My phone started ringing at 5:30 in the morning, and I can't use this language on the radio. But essentially, Chuck Fairbanks was saying, what is wrong with you? Are you out of your effing mind? I said, either one could play the position. I know you can feel it, can't you?
I can. Oh, God. Oh, yes.
One little letter. So I was crying. I called Will McDonough. I said, what am I going to do? And Willie said, you get your fanny down to practice right now, and you wait till everybody shows up, and you apologize. And I did.
Well, you were so lucky, too, to not only be working with so many talented people, but so many people who were there to support you along the way and help you out in so many different ways, too. I went back and revisited your wonderful memoir, by the way. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk. And it was Peter Gammons who scored an extra ticket for you to get into the press box to see maybe the greatest baseball game of all time, Game 6 of the 75 World Series.
You know, it was unbelievable. Yes, Peter went to Tony Kubek. They were doing, actually, my former husband, Dick Stockton, as many people know, he called Carlton Fisk's home run, and that was the night I met him. And yeah, Peter got me a credential. I don't know how, it would be so impossible now. And I just sat in the press box. I kept quiet. Someone had introduced me to Dick before the game, but, you know, it was a huge game for everybody. And, you know, I've told this before, how before Dwight Evans had that monster in the eighth inning, I think it was Ray Fitzgerald's lead had been, because you're typing them, you know, on the typewriter to give for them to fax it over to the Globe. And his lead was, you could feel it slipping away. And then, of course, after Dewey did his thing, he ripped it out. Ray ripped it out of the typewriter, and I, like, crawled around the floor, you know, like I was finding the first Gutenberg press Bible or something. And I, you know, I kept it forever. It was, yeah, really, really powerful to grow up. I think being from Boston, I always tell people, or New England, we care about three things. We care about sports and politics and talking about sports and politics. So I think you're lucky too. We're really lucky to have New England connections.
And a couple of guys who made it possible for you to finally get in a locker room, but perhaps not what people would expect. It was tennis, right? Team tennis, the Boston Lobsters. And that was made possible through Bob Kraft. And also, I'm sure Bud Collins helped out. And then George Blaney, who was the longtime coach at Holy Cross.
Yes, yes. I mean, I have to say, I owe so much of my career to Bob Kraft, because actually to Myra also, because the Boston Globe assigned me. You know, I was very young. It was like 76 or something. I was right out of Boston College, and one of my beats were the Lobsters, and which were named by Bud, right? The Lobsters. And so there were no provisions anywhere in America for equal access, and Myra said to Bob Kraft, let her in. Who cares? You know, she's qualified. She's going to cover it. And it was wild because Jan Tyriak was the coach, and he would smoke in the locker room. And it was really nuts. And then, yes, George Blaney, I was the beat writer for Boston College basketball. And so, of course, they'd play Holy Cross. And George Blaney, yeah, he allowed me in. And then, of course, he went on to be great coach himself, great assistant at Connecticut, which, you know, here comes the Final Four. I always say Jim Calhoun built a dynasty out of the desert.
We're talking with Leslie Visser here on Downtown. That incredible staff of the Globe back in, well, really from the 70s through the mid-80s were so good. But what about management? What role did that play? Did they play in making sure that these people were able to do their work?
Oh, yeah. The Globe was really, really strong. I mean, Will McDonough, well, actually Willie, he called Billy Sullivan, as you know, then the owner of the Patriots. And Willie said, we're going to have a woman on the beat, and that's that. And he hung up. And next thing you know, I'm covering the Patriots. But, you know, they had no provisions for equality. At least my first 5 years in the league, I was doing all the interviews out in the parking lot. Didn't matter if it rained, snowed, whatever. So that's why, I'm so encouraged now. There are so many women covering the NFL, covering all sports.
So, how has sports journalism evolved in these years? And we're headed in the right direction. We're not there yet. We're not where we would all like to be.
Well, if you ask a woman, it can't happen fast enough or more enough for us. But I look now and you see women, you see a woman on almost every broadcast, be it, it could be play-by-play, it could be a reporter. There are women writers in the press box. There are all kinds of digital women. We now are starting to see women. My friend Lisa Leslie coaches the men's team in the Big Three. So I sort of think, and at CBS, we have great people. Tracy Wolfson's fantastic. We have Lisa Byington and Beth Mullen doing play-by-play. So I'm just really proud of something that started, when they didn't even have ladies' rooms, and now we're all over the place.
So do you think for years, especially in terms of something like play-by-play, was that hesitance on the part of ownership, of media outlets, management, or was it the fans that maybe in some cases still can't quite handle having a woman do the play-by-play of a game?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of everything that you just said, Rich, because men didn't like to hear a woman's voice. Of course, now the number one sport brand in the world from the United States are the Yankees, and Susan Waldman, who of course is from Boston, she's been on there for 20 years. So people did get used to it. I think also management resisted, sort of the old chromosomal thing, like, well, how can she recognize a safety blitz? But heck, I did Monday Night Football. I was the first woman on Monday Night Football, and I did it with the greatest, Al Michaels, and he never played a down of football. So I used to say, it's not genetic. It's, do you have the passion? Do you have the knowledge? Can you recognize it? And I think now women, I think we were all a little nervous, in the beginning to say, I can do this. But it's just been shown so many times that women can. We had, after me, the great Jackie McMullen at the Boston Globe. So there have been great women at the Herald. And I don't know, you see them everywhere. And I love it. Like the other night when Caitlin Clark played Angel Reese, there were seven women, and we were all on a text about every single play. You might know Andrea Joyce. NBC and Mary Carrillo. So now there's like a whole posse of us, and we talk all the time.
Your path, I think, was unique in that you had that writing background. As you said, you will always be a writer. What kind of advantage does that give someone when they go into broadcasting, having that writing background?
It's been enormous. It's what sustained me. I mean, I'm 70 years old now, and I still have a network contract. People come and go all the time. And I think it's because your vocabulary is so much greater. Like when people just use the word awesome, I speak at a lot of colleges, they use the word awesome. And I say, what does that mean? Was it exciting? Was it large in size? Was it the first? How was it singular? But because that word doesn't really mean anything. So I think the more you read, the more analogies you have. And, the Globe people, God forbid you never use the cliche. you tried to say something in an original way. And I think that's why the Globe got voted the number one sports section for like 10 straight years.
I work with young people teaching high school, and I say to them all the time, I don't care what line of work it is you're going into. The more you read, the more you know, the better you'll be in whatever those future endeavors are.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, most of the great screenwriters also have, they're well-read, they write things, and everything, because communication is so important, that I do think that when I was married to Dick, he used to laugh that both of us always had a bullpen of books. right over there, okay, I'll get to that one. But I try to read anything, even things that are hard for me, Japanese architecture, I don't really know much about it, but someday an analogy, it may be important.
Well, isn't that part of being good at what you do? The fact that you, and I say this to Bob Ryan all the time when he comes on the show, one of the reasons Bob is still so great is that he's never lost his curiosity.
Correct. Matter of fact, I'll tell you Bob's story in a second. Eleanor Roosevelt, who said the greatest thing a child can have is curiosity, because it'll sustain you your whole life. So the other day, so I'm on a text with those guys too. So it's like Lee and Dan and Ryan, you know, we're all the same people for like 50 years. And I was saying about Connecticut, you know, getting to the Final Four, they're going for their, sixth title, they're tied with Duke for five. And I said, holy West Balmasupnia, remember him? And Bob goes on, which only Bob can do, saying, yes, the first time I saw him, he scored 28 and had 6 rebounds. And you know that's exactly right.
Well, of course.
And then he went into Toby Kimball, and it was like the schools, well, which Maine was, the Yankee Conference.
Right.
So, yeah, I think I just was so blessed to have 10 years at the Globe.
Bud Collins was such a unique talent. Can you share a story or two about working with him and being friends with Bud?
Yeah, I was privileged. I was one of the 4 people his family asked to speak at his memorial, which was so big they had to hold it at Trinity Church, you know, across from the public library in Boston. He touched everyone. No one was too big or too small. And at Wimbledon, the first Wimbledons I covered with him, we had to send our copy by Western Union. And so Bud, I remember, like, we'd be sitting there, and all kinds of people would be on all kinds of deadlines around the world, and Bud would be typing, and someone would walk up to him and say, Bud, who was the last Romanian female in the quarterfinals? And Bud would just look up while he was typing, you know, and say, Virginia Rozic, 1978, you know, or whatever. And it was like he took a ticket at the bakery, you know. Everybody wanted Bud's time, and he had time for everybody. And then he would have a restaurant called Santa Croce, which is on Cheney Walk in London. And anybody could come to dinner because it stays so light, so late in London. Wimbledon would go, you know, till 10 o'clock at night. And then we'd all go to Santa Croce, and Bud always had a table for 12. Sometimes it was 6 people. Usually on July 4th, they didn't used to play on the off Sunday at Wimbledon, and we were all the expats on July 4th, and so that would be about 18 people, you know, Billie Jean and Pam Shriver, anybody who was American, and Bud would organize it. He was just, oh God, we miss him every day.
I wanted to ask you about the coverage of women, and you mentioned the wonderful basketball game the other night between Iowa and LSU. Do you find that there are still elements of the sports broadcasting world or sports journalism in general, but particularly sports radio, where they treat women differently? And I think of an Angel Reese or a Caitlin Clark and behavior that would be seen as a positive if it were a male athlete is viewed very differently when it's a female athlete.
I don't think it's by a majority. I think it's by a few, which is really the difference. I remember, you know, if I asked a strange question or something, I would have been immediately condemned. But in the last, I would say, 5 years now, you see teams and players defending a woman if she's not treated properly, which is just a massive turnaround. But I think most people looked at it like those are two very competitive women, and it's between the lines, and they're very different, you know, different. They come from different backgrounds, but I think most people just saw the greatness of their game. And honestly, I think that Caitlin Clark, she must have Havlicek's pulse, don't you think?
Oh, yes,
She doesn't show any pressure or nervousness, shoots from the logo. You know, she's not Steph Curry. People are trying to say she isn't Steph Curry, but she is so farther. When I went to high school, which was in Western Mass, out by the Berkshires, I was one of the rovers. There were 6 girls on the team, and only 2 of us could cross half court. I'm not talking about the 1800s here, but it was like they thought we'd get too winded. So, I mean, it's really just been astonishing, and really the result of Title IX that created everything we're seeing today.
Well, the landscape has changed, certainly, from the 1970s. Newspapers have their struggles. And I know, you know, even around here, we've got a couple network affiliates that don't really have local sportscasters on the air anymore. Is it more difficult for newcomers to get into the business today? Or does the internet and podcasting and all of that create these new opportunities that they're different but still provide those options for people?
Yeah, anybody can call himself a journalist now, which doesn't make you a journalist, but people, you know, they say it or they feel like they can. But there are a lot more opportunities. They don't pay very well. And, you know, I so lament the demise of newspapers. The Globe was a little late in adjusting to the digital side, but now they're, you know, got that going. But, you know, I go around the country still all the time doing sports, and so many papers have gone out of business, and they'll just take the Associated Press, or they don't cover things. I mean, I felt like I was really in a golden age where the Globe sent people to do everything, really. I mean, I got, and even at CBS now, you know, now we have, everyone has a streaming side, and some of those are doing well, some are struggling, but there isn't any more where you just know that something, you can find it in one place, unless they're big events, which is why the networks, we pay $2 billion a year to have the NFL, because you can't get that anywhere else. You can only get the Super Bowl on the network that's carrying it.
The Boston Bullpen Project presents the Dream Team, the 1980s Boston Globe sports staff. That's April 14th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Jordan's Furniture IMAX Theater in Reading, Mass. It's going to be a wonderful evening. Leslie, it is always a treat for us to get to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us, as always, and we wish you much continued success and good health.
Oh, Rich, there's a reason everybody loves talking to you, and if you're not doing anything, you have to come.
That sounds fantastic. I hope I can make it. Hope I can make it there. And by the way, if you haven't already, read Leslie's wonderful memoir, Sometimes You Have to Cross When It Says Don't Walk. Leslie Visser, thank you so much.
Bye, Rich. Thank you.
And again, that's coming up on Sunday the 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. Jordan's Furniture IMAX Theater in Reading, Massachusetts. The Boston Bullpen Project presents The Dream Team, the 1980s Boston Globe sports staff. Our thanks to the great Leslie Visser for visiting with us. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, actor Jake Reiner talks about his brand new film, Love and Taxes, next on Downtown.
The better way to a better window, renewal by Anderson.
Hey there, homeowners. It's Troy Pearl. We get it. You think, why should I invest more in windows and doors when I can just grab something off the shelf at the box store? Well, here's the scoop. We're not your typical off-the-rack solution. We might cost a bit more than those high-maintenance vinyl or wooden options, but let me tell you, we're worth every penny. Our FiberX material is 2 times stronger than vinyl and retains its stability in all climates. Our price includes installation and a warranty. And with us, you get to pick out everything, from glass options to interior and exterior colors, to hardware styles, and more. It's the customized touch your home deserves.
Right now, for a limited time, save 20% off your entire purchase, plus an additional discount of $299. To schedule your free in-home consultation, visit rbagreatermaine.com.
The better way to a better window, renewal by Anderson.
Here on Downtown, our next guest comes from a Hollywood royalty. His dad is actor-director Rob Reiner, his grandfather, the great Carl Reiner. Jake has carved out a career path of his own as a newscaster and a podcast host, and now is doing some terrific acting in a brand new film called Love and Taxes. We had a chance to talk with Jake about his career and the making of the film. By the way, I was looking back. It was in 2017. We had your grandfather on the show, and absolutely one of the highlights of my time doing this. And what an incredibly gracious and kind man he was.
Yes, he was that way on the air and off the air as a family man. What you saw is what you got with him, and I'm happy that you got a chance to interview him.
Yeah, he had just done the Today Show where he was demonstrating the workout that he did in bed in the morning. And I said, I have to tell you, that's a pretty strenuous workout. And I don't know if I could handle that. And he said, Rich, when a 96-year-old man tells you to do something, you do it.
Exactly. He could lift his leg like a rocket. He was very, very limber up until the end.
Well, I want to talk about this wonderful movie of yours, Love and Taxes. I had a chance to check it out over the weekend, and it was just terrific. Funny, but also brilliant in the way it's structured, too. And without giving too much away, I thought I knew what was happening. And then I got lured in to the story of these two, Donald, a hope-to-be CPA, who eventually becomes one, and Belinda, who has an agenda of her own. It is such a wonderful story.
Yeah, it really is. And you really get to see the journey of these two characters because they're pretty much the only two characters in the entire film. And it was originally written as a play by Lloyd Schwartz, and he had the idea of wanting to turn it into a movie, but he wanted to do it in a very specific way, which is we do each scene as one take. And there are, I don't know if you counted, Rich, there are only 7 scenes in the whole movie. And each scene is about 20 to 30 pages long. So you can imagine how long these scenes actually are. And the fact that both me and Alexis Abrams, who played Belinda, had to memorize all these lines and not mess up once. Because if you do, you have to go back to the beginning and restart the whole take. Not only that, we had one camera and a boom mic operator that we had to operate and dance around. And there were a lot of instances where there would be a boom shadow on my face, or the camera would bump into the wall, or I would forget where I am, and we'd forget a line, and we have to go all the way back to the beginning. So it was an artistic achievement that I'd never really ever considered doing in my entire life, never thought that I could ever pull it off, and we did it. And that to me is honestly the biggest pull for why people should want to watch this movie.
Now, Lloyd Schwartz, am I right that he's the son of Sherwood Schwartz?
Yes, he is, of the Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island fame.
That's fantastic. Well, it's great. You and Alexis have such tremendous chemistry together, and that's obviously that has to happen or this whole thing doesn't work, but you guys are great together.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was a really long process, thousands and thousands of submissions we hear, and it all got brought down to the final four. You know, we're in the March Madness world right now, so I guess that's an appropriate term to use, where it was me and another person going up for Donald and Alexis and another actress going up for Belinda. They brought us to this little studio in L.A. where they brought in, you know, the directors and the producers and the writers of the movie. And we basically had to audition in front of all of these people. And then they made their decision. And I felt that I had more chemistry with Alexis than anyone else that we auditioned with. And Ken Feinberg, who co-directed this movie, called me and said, who did you have more chemistry with? And I told him that it was Alexis. And Alexis had told Ken that she had the most chemistry with me, so it kind of just worked out seamlessly. And then we worked really well together pretty much throughout the whole process.
And did I read along the way that you shot the whole thing in 3 days?
3 days,
wow.
Rich. 3 days. And I'll tell you why. So this was shot during the summer last year. And if you remember, there was a big strike going on with the actors and writers. And there were a select few projects that were SAG after approved that could go and continue production if they met a certain criteria, and our film was under the SAG micro-budget agreement. So we were able to shoot this movie, but the constraint was is that we had to do it in a very small amount of time. We flew to Atlanta in July. We spent a total of a week plus there. And because there were only 7 scenes in the whole movie, you could shoot 2 scenes a day and call it a day. And that is what Ken Feinberg and Craig Tallis, who's the other director, that's what they decided to do. Let's see how efficient we can shoot this movie. And so we only took 3 days to shoot 7 scenes. And it was an undertaking like no other. You add to the fact that it was in Atlanta in the middle of summer, just oven heat of epic proportions.
And wearing those heavy 70s clothes, too.
Oh, my God, Rich. I mean, I was born in the 90s, so I don't know what that was like to go to work every day wearing that kind of attire. But I never, ever would envy that of anybody, because those thick 70s suits were very unforgiving. You couple that with the heat in Atlanta, the fact that you have to kill the air conditioning before you start shooting.
Right.
And you add to the fact that I just sweat profusely anyway. I was dying. And you can see me in a few of the takes through the movie just wiping sweat away from my forehead because it was getting into my eyes. And to be able to
see, I thought that was acting. That was acting, Jake. I thought, no, Donald's nervous. He's going to get caught.
Exactly. Well, I was nervous about remembering my line. So it kind of played. So I'm glad that it played for you, Rich. But like all of those factors at play to be able to concentrate and memorize all these lines and get through the scene was an undertaking, like I said, I've never done before. But we were able to pull it off. And I was so proud of that.
Well, and it must have been in some ways like doing a play.
It was. It really was. It was like filming a play. But Lloyd, who didn't want it to look like a play, wanted it to look more like a movie than a play. We added these dream sequences too. So where, you know, Belinda is kind of talking about, you know, how she, you know, fell in love with various characters. I'm not going to go into any of the details about that, but we basically used, you know, the one office set and built a dream sequence portion of it so that when the camera panned by one of the windows, that was the dream sequence. That was Belinda's diner that she works at, that she's a waitress at. So it was a really cool way to kind of change from scene to scene because there are no cuts throughout the whole scene. So you have to move from the inner office to the lobby to the dream sequence and then back into the inner office. It was kind of a real choreographed dance.
Well, the structure of the film was so terrific. I love the costumes were great. Having grown up in the 70s and remembering polyester so well, that was fabulous. The photographs that you used to set up the transition between each scene were wonderful. And the music, whoever was responsible for picking the music, that was a great part of it, too. But what was terrific to see is, and again, I didn't expect it early on. I thought, hey, it's comedy. It's a light comedy. It's going to be fun. But there was so much character development over the course of these seven scenes.
Right, exactly. And you really see the journey that both of them take with those transitions, because we had to move the plot along. Each scene is 1 year later. So you kind of get to see how, you know, Donald's personal life unravels in, you know, over the course of a few years. Also, Belinda's timeline, how her backstory unravels over time. And the idea that these two people obviously have this this insane connection with one another, they're never quite on the same timeline. They're always missing each other. There's always some factor that gets in the way of them lining up. And the struggle of that is so relatable to today, because you could have, you know, a huge crush on someone and they could have a huge crush on you, but the timing of it just may never work out. And sometimes it never works out and you're going to have to deal with that. But in this instance, you see where it is able to work and where it isn't. And just the two characters kind of always missing each other just kind of keeps it interesting throughout.
Some great lines in it too. One early on in the film, I wrote it down. It was so good. I think I want to put this on a business card where she says to you, "You're ethical to a point. That's worthy of some consideration."
Right. Exactly. That's just the satirical, the dry sense of humor that Lloyd has. And we actually have a lot more in common than we realized going into it. Obviously, our family's background, our, you know, sort of Hollywood legacy background, you've got that. You've got the fact that both of us are huge Dodgers fans. We're diehard Dodgers fans. And then the kicker for me, which was the weirdest thing, is that the two of us have the exact same birthday.
Wow.
We're both born on May 2nd, which I mean, just the stars align for this project in a lot of ways. And I just love the way Lloyd writes because it's very my style of comedy. I have a dry sense of humor. I have sort of the quick wit reports a lot to what people say. And the way he wrote was just kind of perfect how I normally would talk.
Well, it's laugh out loud funny, but it's also sweet. It's poignant. It really is a terrific film. So now what's happening here? Are you, I know you're applying to festivals. Is that the next step?
That's right. We have applied to a number of different festivals, and we have the honor of showing up at two of them now. One of them is Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. That's coming up on April 26th. And then the other one here in L.A. is the Beverly Hills Film Festival, May 3rd. So those are our kind of coming out party, our debut for this film. And we're hoping that, you know, from that, we can get a distribution partner and sell this movie, but also maybe gain traction and get into other festivals as well.
We're talking with Jake Ryder. The new film is called Love and Taxes. I want to talk a little bit about you and your background. You went to Syracuse, the cradle of sportscasters. I know you're a Vin Scully guy. Did you think that maybe that's what you wanted to do, become the next Scully, the next Bob Costas?
That's exactly what I wanted to do. And they call Syracuse Sportscaster U for a reason. There's a lot of great alumni that have come from it, Bob Costas being one of them. I did want to become the next Vin Scully. I knew that I was a decent ball player, but not good enough to do anything beyond, you know, playing in high school. So I thought the next best thing would be to call baseball games. And that's kind of what my original thought was when I got into Syracuse. But then while I was there, I kind of developed a passion for news broadcasting, which was kind of interesting. And talking to some of my professors there, they were sort of saying, you know, every, you know, guy wants to go into sports broadcasting. But if you can carve out a nice little career for yourself in news, you can kind of climb the ladder a little bit faster and get to a larger market in a shorter amount of time, which is exactly what happened. I developed this passion for news, and I kind of went on this sort of three-stop tour, beginning in Salinas, Monterey, Central Coast, California, which is a gorgeous place to start. Then I jumped pretty significant market size up to Houston, which is top 10 in Houston, Texas. And then I came back home and got to work for my hometown station, KCAL KCBS. And total time of doing this job was about 10 years. So I had a great experience being a broadcast journalist. I reported, I anchored, I covered sports, I covered news. I got to have the best of both worlds, because as a news reporter that knows a lot about sports, you get those assignments all the time. You get the Super Bowls and the Final Fours and the World Series, because they need news reporters to cover those things. And I had a unique set of, you know, knowledge and skills when it comes to that. So I kind of was the perfect candidate. And that's what I tell, you know, sort of young people that are coming up through the business that are going into broadcast news, that want to do sports and maybe aren't getting the traction they need. There are other routes.
Yeah, and you got the chance to do both. You started your baseball podcast talking about the Dodgers. Is that still going?
Oh, yeah. That's something that I joined during the pandemic because I had taken a year off from doing news, kind of trying to figure out what the heck was going on in the world. So I felt like erring on the side of caution was probably the best decision for me. And I joined these guys, Kevin Klein, David Rosenthal. They're my two co-hosts on the Incline Dodgers podcast. We're a fan-driven Dodgers podcast, but all three of us are very, very knowledgeable baseball fans and just insane Dodgers fans. We watch all the games. We hang out together. We know all the stats, and we know all the trends, and we follow the team really well. And so you really get a great kind of comprehensive look at the team, as opposed to just having fans that love the game and watch the game that don't really follow it as intently as we do. And so I feel like our podcast really gives the real, like, nitty gritty stuff for Dodgers fans that really want to dive deep into, you know, who their, you know, long reliever is coming out of the bullpen and how, you know, give him some time, because when August rolls around, that's when he really kicks into gear. I mean, those kinds of insights that we provide. So the Incline Dodgers podcast has been a really fun ride. We've gained a lot of fans over the years, and continue to do that on a weekly basis. And it's just been a ton of fun as a diehard Dodgers fan and baseball fan.
How much of that love of baseball came from your family?
All of it. Literally all of it. My grandfather was a huge baseball fan growing up. He was he grew up in New York. My dad grew up in New York. They were both New York Giants fans, the New York baseball Giants, before they moved to San Francisco. That was their team. My dad grew up loving Willie Mays. But they both became Dodgers fans for different reasons. My grandfather became a Dodgers fan because he started following Jackie Robinson and fell in love with Jackie Robinson and what he stood for. So he became a Brooklyn Dodgers fan and then followed them out to LA. And my dad became a Dodgers fan because the Giants ended up trading Willie Mays to the Mets, which was blasphemous in his opinion. And he never forgave them for that. So he jumped ship, became a Dodgers fan. He also moved out to LA too. And so it kind of made sense. And both of them passed that down to me, and my love and passion and knowledge for baseball directly comes from them.
Please tell Mookie we miss him here in New England.
I bet you guys do. And each day I watch Mookie Betts, I think, what were the Red Sox thinking? And you look at, and sorry to kind of get sidetracked here for a little bit, but the return that the Red Sox got for Mookie Betts, I mean, Verdugo's in New York. Yep. Jeter Downs didn't end up panning out. He's not even on the team anymore. And I think you got a catcher too.
Connor Wong, at least for now, the starting catcher, because you like the light hitting catchers who can steal a base every once in a while.
Right. That's what you get a catcher for, right?
Yes.
That's the only reason you want a catcher for. So yeah, that was a head scratcher for me for sure.
Yeah. We're still wondering about that here throughout the Northeast. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the broadcasting journey that you made. You always had acting in the back of your mind. Was any of that interest in broadcasting an attempt to sort of carve out some territory of your own that was away from, for lack of a better term, the family business?
Yes and no. I wasn't so much that I went the broadcasting route because I didn't want to go into acting or because I wanted to separate myself. I really did have a passion for it, and I developed a lot of great skills as a result. But I've always loved performing at any level, in any venue. I mean, I have a pretty extensive background in improv comedy. I did a lot of improv while I was in Houston. But as a broadcaster, I felt that I was playing a character on TV. I mean, they tell you in school, you know, to make it about, you know, bring yourself to it, obviously, bring your personality. But like when you're covering a triple murder, you're not necessarily going to be yourself, you know, like, you know, as a bystander, you might say things out loud to the people around you that you probably wouldn't want to air publicly. And so when you get on air, you have that kind of buttoned up type of feel. And so you have that style. So I always felt that I was playing this character. But then the parts of which that I loved the most about broadcast news were those kind of softball stories, like the Mother's Day flowers, you know, those kinds of stories, or, you know, saving a cat in a tree, or, you know, what's it like to be a beekeeper inside the mind of a beekeeper? You know, how dangerous is it? You know, those types of fun stories, I felt like I could really open up my personality and really put a lot of my dry sense of humor into it, my writing into it. I also felt that way at KCAL when they gave me an opportunity to be a sports anchor, I was one of the anchors of Sports Central, which was our weekend highlight show. And I got to basically, you know, dive into these highlights and describe things in ways that only I could describe them. And that was a lot of fun for me to be able to write these highlights the way I wanted to and kind of show my personality that way. But ultimately, I felt that there were a lot of limitations to what I could do in broadcasting. And I didn't really want to be covering the day-to-day mundane, you know, stabbing, murder, fire, you know, housing market crash or whatever story was going on, because it's such a hit or miss. You know, you could get a string of just terrible, depressing stories and have a terrible week, or a string of great stories that you never really know. And I always felt that I wanted to perform more. I wanted to be an actor. And the things that I liked about broadcasting just weren't there as consistently as I wanted them to be. And so then I decided that once I was back here in LA, that I was kind of going to do both. And so I did both for a while. And eventually, as of last May, I was let go from KCAL News, and I was able to pursue acting full time. And I've been doing that ever since.
You're in the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, right?
I am. Yeah. Episode 4. I got to do a little bit on that. And for me, that was a dream come true, because Curb Your Enthusiasm is one of my favorite shows of all time. Seinfeld is my favorite show of all time. So to be able to be around Larry David, Tracy Ullman, Jeff Garlin, and Susie, all four of those people were in the scene that I was in. So getting to watch them, these like titans, it was like, you know, to kind of create a sports analogy, it was like an all-star game. It was like the best of the best at their craft doing improv for one of the most successful shows of all time was just like a dream come true for me. And then to be in a scene with them was just the best thing ever. And definitely one of the coolest moments of my life.
Well, the new movie is called Love and Taxes. Watch for it. Hopefully we'll see it out there in theaters and streaming services going forward. It is a wonderful movie. You're so good in it. You've got great comic timing, such an engaging personality on screen. You bring Donald to life at so many different levels and so many depths. So it's been great to talk with you. We wish you luck with Love and Taxes and everything else in your career going forward. Thanks for being with us today, Jake.
Of course, Rich, anytime you want me on, I will gladly join you. I hope this season for the Red Sox is a lot better than last season. But I can't make any promises.
Connor Wong will lead us to the promised land. Thanks, Jake.
Thank you.
That is Jake Reiner talking about his new film, Love and Taxes, here on Downtown. Our thanks to Jake. Thanks to the great Leslie Visser, and of course to you for spending some time with us. Downtown is produced by Carrie Haskell from the spacious New Orleans studios and is brought to you every week by Renewal by Anderson, the better way to a better window. We'll see you next time right here on Downtown.